You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. By some measures, Stuart Resnick is the biggest farmer in California. His empire of almonds, pomegranates, pistachios, and citrus covers over 120,000 acres in the San Joaquin Valley. Known today as the Wonderful Company, Resnick and his wife Linda have grown their multi-billion dollar fortune on products like Palm Wonderful pomegranate juice and Wonderful Halos mandarin oranges. And despite California's drought, in recent years they've kept growing, thanks in part to shrewd management of their most precious resource, water. Now, in a new piece for the California Sunday magazine, journalist Mark Arax digs deep into the story of the Resnicks, their fortune, philanthropy, and their control of water in California's agricultural heartland. It's a preview of his upcoming book on water in the Golden State and offers a rare inside look into the wonderful empire. Mark Arax joins us now in our studio. Mark, welcome.
Hey, Joe.
California has had no shortage of land barons and agriculture titans, people like Henry Miller, J.G. Boswell. Are Stuart and Linda Resnick just the next link in that chain, or are they something different?
I think they're the next link in the chain. I also think there's something different. You have to go back to the Wheat Kings, Isaac Friedlander, in the 1870s to find farmers who really weren't farmers. I mean, the Wheat Kings all lived on Nob Hill in San Francisco, and from afar they kind of managed the land. Henry Miller was also, you know, an industrialist from San Francisco, but he had his finger on the operation quite a bit, on that horse, you know, up and down, the cattle king. You still see his imprint there on in Los Banos and Firebaugh and places like that, Mendota. I think the Resnicks are different because of the crops they're growing. They're really high-end things. And then they've wedded that growing to the marketing. So you see a kind of coming together of L.A. hype culture and San Joaquin Valley farming culture. And they've done things in a way that I think breaks some of those molds. And I also think that the philanthropy they're doing is extraordinary. Boswell did a lot of philanthropy, especially in and around Corcoran. The football stadium, the local hospital, senior citizen center. But the Resnicks have, you know, they're doing something quite a ways beyond that.
You write that Resnick got where he is today because he's a gambler. It's been one especially lucky streak, has it not?
Well, he says it's all luck. I think that's probably, you know, maybe a third of it. Good timing, good luck, but also being smart about things and then having his wife there. I mean, she's a pretty extraordinary marketer. So the combination of the two of them. And if you see the way the piece really deals with it, and the book really deals with how they built this empire. And, you know, it started, I mean, Stuart Resnick is, you know, his father owned a bar in New Jersey. And he said he would come home and sometimes the car wouldn't be there. His dad had lost it in a gambling bet. So he comes west in 1956 and then starts off at UCLA Law School. And by the time he's finished, he started up these cleaning businesses in L.A., and he's well on his way to being a millionaire right there. And then just one thing morphs into another. And then it's not until the late 70s that he comes up and over the mountain to the valley and decides to invest in some farmland in Delano, you know, where the Cesar Chavez movement started.
So why agriculture for him? He could have put that money into just about anything, real estate, other investments, which he also did. But why agriculture? And how does this kid from New Jersey, who presumably hasn't driven a tractor, manage to become such a titan of valley agriculture?
I think what happened is he just saw a good deal in Delano on some citrus ground and a packing house and figured, well, this is land and, you know, it's a hedge against inflation. And that's how he started. And then the profits were like crazy those first few years. I mean, who knows what would have happened if you'd have hit a drought right away or a bad streak or something like that. He didn't. And He bought land for pretty cheap from the oil companies, who were, you know, not really farmers anyhow. They planted stuff, but so he bought it for cheap, and it just, you know, kind of one thing led to the other, and that stitching together that empire is also something that, you know, I delve into how it was done. And, you know, it's at the point today where he doesn't even know how many acres he's really farming. I mean, it changes all the time. He owns 180,000 acres of California real estate, you know, land. 121,000 of those acres are now being farmed. You know, he's the biggest pistachio, almond, citrus, and pomegranate grower in the world. And then he processes all those as well. So he's not only controlling his nuts, but he's controlling the nuts of other growers, okay? So, you know, almonds and pistachios that he's processing for, you know, so he controls, especially in pistachios, he controls 40% of the marketing of pistachios, of the whole trade.
And it's not just crops that he controls, but also water.
Yes.
How did he manage to gain such an influential role in managing, or at least have such power over, water resources in the state?
You have to look at his land throughout the valley. And he's even gone into the wine country too, both in North and in Paso Robles. So he's farming in areas that draw from the Central Valley Project, the federal project. He's farming in areas that draw from the State Water Project. Then he's farming in areas where the groundwater is good and he can pump it. And then he's farming in areas where there's no groundwater and he has to depend on the state system. And in flood years, he's able then to take some extra water and park it in a water bank in Kern.
Which he controls.
The water bank was a state project. The taxpayers of California jump-started it with $74 million. But the state really couldn't get its act together on this. And Kern County wanted local control. So the state not having its, you know, stuff together, and the county then resisting, ended up in a situation where, well, who was going to run this water bank? Who was going to control it? And they had a series of secret meetings in Monterey. And as part of the back and forth trading, the Resnick Empire basically ended up controlling the water bank. They have a 50-55% interest in that. So they're able to draw on that. But the problem with our last drought was it was 5 years, 6 years, and they used up all the water in the water bank, or all the water that they could get out of it. And then the state water project, 1 year, didn't deliver any water, and in 2 other years, really cut back on it. So the question became is, how is this empire watering its crops? And so when I went to Lost Hills in Kern County over the last few years, that was the question of my mind. I mean, they had record harvests on their trees, and I couldn't understand, for the life of me, how that was happening given the lack of water.
And you found a pipe.
I found a pipeline. Field man at Wonderful saw me driving around. I was skulking around in these areas out there in the middle of nowhere. And, you know, I told him my dilemma, and he said, well, go next to the California Aqueduct off a road called Twisselman, and you will see a pipeline. It's a private off-the-books pipeline, and it's bringing water from 40 miles away into the orchards of Wonderful, into Resnick's orchards. And so I use that kind of mystery of where that water is coming from, where it's going to, who set it up, as a way to tug you through this narrative, because it's a long narrative.
And we'll get into that in a little bit, and maybe some cracks that might be appearing in the empire of Wonderful. So much of this is about marketing, though. You drive down Highway 99, as you describe, in Delano, and you see the giant new facility there for Halos and that four-story box. That's Linda Resnick's idea,
yeah.
I take it. And a lot of these things are her idea.
Yeah, really smart. It was just a storage place. So what she does is she decides, well, this is four stories. With some lighting, it could be quite dramatic. and it looks like an almighty box of halos up there. And so you're driving, and you're not sure, you know, what it is, but it's a box of halos with the fruit peeking out, and they have halos on them. Wonderful piece of advertising. All that marketing, from the pomegranate juice to the wonderful pistachios and almonds to Fiji water, that's all, you know, a lot of it comes, you know, started with Linda. She's got a crew now and everything else, but she's still very hands-on on that. So they're this really extraordinary, interesting, quirky couple. You know, there are not a lot of Jewish farmers in the valley. There are not a lot of farmers from New Jersey and New York in the valley. There are not a lot of husbands and wives running agricultural enterprises in the valley. So they're breaking the mold in so many ways.
Breaking the mold also in Lost Hills. The community you describe in this piece in the California Sunday magazine is has to be one of the most unusual communities in Central California. You write about seeing what is essentially a modern-day company town there and the elaborate lengths the Resniks have gone to put their touch on just about everything there. And you write, "The believer and the skeptic do their tussle inside my head." Which one won out?
The story is, the two chapters in the book are very conflicted on this question about, you know, benevolence and philanthropy and what's being gained and what's being gamed, you know. And so I'm not sure where it ends up. It ends up in that kind of muddy middle, like I say. I mean, it's not one way or the other. So let me explain that. Lost Hills was essentially a company town for 20-some years. At some point late in the game, in the last 5 years, the Resniks decided to start really donating money to that place. And not just Lost Hills, to some of the other communities like Avenal and Delano, where their workers are. And it's not small giving. You know, you're looking at charter schools. You're looking at, you know, housing. You're looking at infrastructure, streets, sidewalks, the charter schools. You know, Linda's not just writing checks out and then handing them to someone. She's writing the checks, and then she's actually designing the programs and the schools themselves, you know, from the architecture to the curricula. Linda's designing it with the help of some experts, of course. But this is not hands-off philanthropy, and that's what's so remarkable about it. But it's got its creepy elements, too. I mean, in the fight against obesity and diabetes in their workforce, they have a cafeteria that serves these very delicious and healthy meals for $3. And she's selling fruits and vegetables out of that restaurant as well. And she's encouraging them to change their diet, you know, telling them that flour tortillas are as bad for you as a can of Coca-Cola. So the philanthropy almost becomes kind of a social engineering in a way. And so you leave there conflicted about it. And so you go to the park and you see in this town, this wonderful park, and I'm double entendre there, but it is wonderful, but it's so perfect. And then you look and you see the branding of it is the wonderful park. And then the O in the wonderful is shaped like a heart, the same heart you see in the bottle of the palm. So it's philanthropy, it's hands-on philanthropy, but it's also philanthropy with a certain level of branding. And that's what makes it complicated to kind of unpack. And so if there's that tussle that I'm talking about in my brain, the skeptic and the believer, that tussle, I think, carries through the entire chapters in the book and in the piece, the magazine piece.
With someone so influential and powerful as Stuart Resnick and Linda as well, as they are our partners in this, what do other people think? Let's start with those people in Lost Hills. What did the workers, the residents there in this company town, what did they share with you about the boss man, essentially?
Yeah.
What do they think?
Well, they really like the boss lady. I mean, she's coming in and delivering stuff and making their lives better. There is some pushback to some of the health things they're trying to do in the company. You know, they've got a gym there and they've got these incentive programs where if you lose a certain amount of weight, you get money. And so there's a little pushback on that. They feel it's a little too coercive. But there's also folks who feel it's quite good. It's changed lives. And there's folks who look around town and say, this place is different with this philanthropy. And how could it not be? That's $50 million a year in some cases. The school in Delano is, you know, the finest charter school in the middle of the state. So, and then she's, you know, when those kids graduate and they go off to college oftentimes with Resnick scholarships. And when Linda noticed that, you know, half the kids were dropping out of school in college, she then decided, well, you know, we need to commit tutors to them in all parts of the state. So there are these Resnick tutors that are serving, and not just tutors, they're kind of life coaches in a way, serving these kids as they go off to college. So this is all singular. It's never been done before. And how do you look inside someone's heart and say, what's the motive? Well, you know, the motive of philanthropy has been complicated in our country since the first giver. I mean, you know, you look at all the robber barons who created libraries and everything else for us, you know, the J.P. Morgans and the Rockefellers and everything. And so there's probably a little guilt to giving, but there's also this idea that this place is the conditions here after, you know, a century of agriculture, kind of a plantation kind of culture, there's a lot of need. And so they're trying to fill that up. And they're challenging other growers to maybe do the same.
And what do other farmers think about the Resnicks?
I think they're a little intimidated by the giving. As I said, Boswell established a real sense of philanthropy. But a lot of agriculture here, a lot of the big farmers, they don't live in the communities they're farming. And that's a real issue. Because when you're not living in a place, you're not invested in that place. You know, you're driving out there or you're flying out there and landing and doing your agriculture, but you're coming back to Northwest Fresno to live. And so there's this disconnect between you and your land in a way. Even as you're farming it, there's this disconnect. It's a psychological disconnect. It's a geographic disconnect. And so our farmers over the decades have given to Fresno State. They've given to Valley Children's Hospital. They've given to St. Agnes. But giving to the communities that they farm in has not really happened to the degree that the Resnicks believe it should. And so they're setting this example. And I think it's making folks take a second look.
What about on the business side, though, especially when you combine that with water? Do the Resnicks throw their weight around in the industry to advance their own agenda? How do other farmers out there, whether they're pistachio growers or their neighbors, especially given the massive amount of pumping that goes on?
Well, they absolutely throw their weight around. You know, a lot of rival pistachio growers consider Stuart Resnick a bully because he controls the market and dictates things. There are small farmers just in the Kings River area where their pumps are drying up because Resnick is able to go deeper into the ground and outpump them. So, you know, the other way that Resnick survived the drought, as it turns out, is he ended up buying an extraordinary amount of water from water-rich irrigation districts, surplus here and there. He spent $200 million during the drought buying water. It pencils out because these crops, especially pistachios, are, you know, bringing in an extraordinary return.
But there are some cracks that are starting to appear in the empire. You write about seeing pomegranate orchards that are no longer in production being torn out right now and a glut of the palm wonderful juice in their tanks. What's going on here? What is happening? And is this a turn of fortune or just a minor bump in the road?
It's a great question. What I explore over the last 4 years in the book that will, you know, hopefully come out later this next year, and in this magazine piece, is that question of, have we extended agriculture too far in the San Joaquin Valley? If you look at the development of agriculture in the valley, we started with the best land, and now we are planting almonds and pistachios in land that used to not even be suitable for cattle grazing. And we're doing that because of drip irrigation. Drip irrigation is allowing you to deliver water and nutrients and all that to a little narrow root zone. And so the return on nuts, now almonds have gone down, but they went down almost by half, but now they're coming back up again. But the return is such that they can afford to do all this pumping and everything. But there's a mining of groundwater going on that, you know, I'm sure you guys have covered already, but I really dig down deep into this. I mean, the subsidence that's happening right now, I mean, the land is sinking no longer by inches, it's by feet. And so agriculture has, because of Resnick and other big growers, and now hedge funds that are coming in and everything else, it has extended its footprint beyond what the water can cover. And so we're going to see a correction that's going to be massive and unprecedented in Valley agriculture. We're going to see probably when the groundwater laws go into effect, which could be another decade or so, but we could see a fallowing of 1 million to 2 million acres of farmland in the Central Valley.
So Stuart Resnick is a smart businessman. He knows what's going on in Sacramento, the Groundwater Act, SGMA, as it's called, in this part of the state that was passed, what was that, 2014, 2015 or so? And again, it's still being implemented. But he has to have his eye not just out 1 year or even 5 years, but 10 years or more. Is he thinking about the sustainability of his operation, both internally, as he is now in his 80s, but also on the environment and natural resources side? Is this a sustainable business?
Yeah, I think what happened during the drought is ultimately they pulled out a lot of acres of pomegranates and 10,000 acres of almonds in Lost Hills. At the end of the piece, I ask him, you know, what's the lesson of the drought? And initially he says, well, what lesson? I mean, it's a drought. You know, the story of California is drought and flood, so you better be prepared for drought. And he really wasn't. He had planted all the way to his margins and beyond. You know, the farmers call that wall-to-wall planting, and that's what they did. And so they had to cut back. And he said, when I pushed him some more, he said, well, the lesson of drought is we want to be in areas that are served by either the state water project or the Central Valley project. Plus we want to be in areas that have groundwater. Now, Kern County, Lost Hills, Western Kern County, Lost Hills, there's no groundwater out there. So he is wholly dependent on the state water project and whatever he can bank in flood years. And that's why he overextended himself. So I think the Resnick Empire already is correcting. Now, we had a flood year last year. They're starting to replant again. But as they're replanting, we're in the midst of perhaps another drought year. And climate change, and the farmers that I talk to acknowledge that it's climate change. The cycles are coming back, and we're cycling through a lot faster than we used to. And it could be that we're going to return to a pattern of drought again. And in that case, you have to have the ability to have a state project, groundwater, and also enough money from the commodities you're selling to buy water on the open market from the rice growers in Sacramento, for instance.
Now, Stuart and Linda Resnick are not the only billionaire farmers in your piece, or even in the Valley for that matter. Let's bring up John Vidovich as we bring this to a close. What role does he play, and has a bit of a complex relationship with Stuart Resnick, does he not?
So as I'm tracing this pipeline that is moving water from Tulare County into Resnick's fields in Kern County, I'm wondering where the water is coming from and who is actually, you know, harvesting it. Well, it turns out that it's John Vidovich, who's a Silicon Valley developer. The family had farmland way back before the Silicon chip. The father developed a lot of the Silicon Valley into houses and things like that. John, who's 60, came up and over the mountain, decided he's going to build an empire here. And what he started doing is buying up a lot of farmland. He owns about 100,000 acres, but he's not farming a lot of it. He's not farming the ground. What he is farming the water. And he's been selling some of that water to the city. Very controversial sales. So the farmers are watching Vidovich closely, not sure what he's up to, but they fear that he's buying land and he's going to strip the water off that land and then send it up and over the mountain, you know. And so what you see is that he and Resnick were at war, and then in this drought they made some peace, and Vidovich decides to deliver some water to Resnick in the worst of the drought to get him through it. And that's what this pipeline, the story of this pipeline, shows, this kind of secret handshake that these two guys do. And is Vidovich a billionaire? He's pretty close. And so it's these two, you know, a near billionaire and a billionaire, or a billionaire and a billionaire.
Hard to know.
Yeah, together and making this thing happen. And that's what I discovered. And that's kind of the mystery that tugs you through the piece.
Is that deal legal?
The farmers in Tulare County whose groundwater is being extracted and then sent two counties over would say it isn't and have sued. And there's a settlement that says he can only take a certain amount of water, but it has to remain within that basin. Well, this water went outside that basin. I'm not a lawyer, so I can't make that call, but it's an interesting question.
Again, we're talking with Mark Erex today on Valley Public Radio. With all of the things that are going on in California and water, we have the Central Valley Project and the State Water Project. Those deliveries are likely never to be what they once were, now that we have environmental considerations that have taken into account that weren't taken in back when those projects were designed. With that in mind, with Sigma in mind, are we going to see more of this, more of what Vidovich is doing, selling off water maybe to another farmer outside the area, or even beyond that, what he did back in 2009 and selling $73 million worth of water to a district over in San Bernardino County? In some way, does the new regulatory environment that we're in almost precipitate the decline of not only Valley agriculture, but maybe shipping what water is left outside the area? Is that a real fear?
So, way back when had we decided to develop agriculture by taking 70% of our river flow and then leaving the other 30% in, we would have developed an agriculture that was sustainable, wouldn't have the kinds of crop gluts that we have, raisin busts and nut busts and fruit busts and all those kinds of things. But we decided to take all the river. Then we decided to take the groundwater. And then when that ran out, we said, bring us a river, steal us a river from afar. And so came the flows of the Sacramento River, the surplus flows. So we were not sustainable a long time ago. So with all this pressure that's happening, it's going to impinge on agriculture. And I think it's going to develop an agriculture in the valley initially that's a lot more sustainable. It's going to be in high-end crops. You're going to see alfalfa probably not grown as much, cotton not as grown as much. That's already happening. And you're going to see acreage come down. Westland's 600,000 acres, now 500,000 acres, will probably end up being 300,000 acres. But it'll be productive and it'll be a lot closer to sustainability. The next step is the tragic step. And what happens is the water becomes more valuable than the crops, and these guys decide to strip the water from the land and sell it to developers in the valley and developers up and over the mountain. And the question becomes is, will this farmland be paved over like we see so much of it being paved over now? And I think ultimately that's where we're going to go. Nothing has stopped the houses up till now. And unless we have some kind of state law that draws a line around agriculture and says you cannot convert these into suburbia, we're going to see the same slow creep happen. And it won't be in our lifetimes, but maybe our grandchildren's lifetimes, where this place will follow the story of Los Angeles.
You've been pursuing this story for years now, pursuing Stuart Resnick for years, and got the cold shoulder for many years, had his secretary hang up on you many times. Why do you think he decided to talk?
I think Linda didn't want him to talk, but I think he basically said, look, he's going to do this thing anyhow. We might as well get our two cents in. And, you know, I try to be fair in this piece. And you asked early on about this kind of messiness, this conflict. Is it black or is it white? And it isn't. It's in the beautiful gray. And so I think he decided to talk just simply to get his story out. And when he did talk at the end, it changed a lot of my story. I was told about all this philanthropy where they were doing. And the piece suddenly, and the book suddenly reflects all of that. Had he not allowed me in to see that, I think the piece would have missed that element.
So where does Resnick go from here? He's in his 80s. What's the plan?
He looks good, man. He's drinking a lot of pomegranate juice. I don't know. You ask him that, and I don't think he knows yet. The sad thing is, if this gets, you know, taken up by some, you know, gets put in a trust and then some hedge fund takes it over, they're not going to have the same investment in the land that he and Linda do. And that's an odd thing to say because they're over in Beverly Hills. They live in Beverly Hills and their company town is in Lost Hills. There's 140 miles as the crow flies distance. But if that goes to some investors in New York, they're just going to strip it. They're going to be strippers. And so I think it'll be a sad day to see that happen. I hope he hangs on to 100.
You can find Mark Arax's new piece about the lives and agriculture and water of Stuart and Linda Resnick in the California Sunday magazine. There's also a link on our website at kvpr.org. And we await that book, hopefully coming out next year, about California water. Mark, thanks so much.
Thanks, Joe.